This is Christy, and I'm reading Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, April 12, 2023. Craddock, House shows support of mental health legislation. By Stuart Doreen. State Republican Tom Craddock announced Tuesday a pair of legislative successes related to mental health. Craddock stated that House Bill 492, which creates a local mental health services district to receive the Permian Basin Behavioral Health Facility upon completion, passed a second vote in the House on Tuesday. The final passage happens after a third reading, which should be Wednesday, according to Craddock's office. Legislation then moves to the Senate. Representatives from both hospital districts supported the legislation when it was heard before the House committee, Craddock's office noted. The Permian Basin Behavioral Health Center received $40 million in funding in October 2021 from the state of Texas. The balance of the funds needed to complete the facility is being raised within the community, according to the release from Craddock's office. The 100-bed facility is currently in design, and it is expected to break ground this spring. The Behavioral Health Center is expected to be located between Midland and Odessa on 54 acres donated by Diamondback Energy, adjacent to University of Texas Permian Basin's Midland campus. The current estimate of the total project cost has increased to $120 million. State leaders have announced a new funding quest for a 100-bed expansion and annual operating costs for a regional facility. A proposed expansion would bring the total to 200 beds and would be comprised of a combination of acute child, adolescent beds, and competency restoration rooms, according to the update. Our communities need behavioral health care access, Craddock said in a news release. This is the next step toward bringing that health care to the Permian Basin. I am appreciative of my colleagues in the Texas House for showing their support for our communities in passing this legislation. I look forward to this bill passing the Texas Senate and being sent to the governor's desk for signature. Craddock Joint offers and passes the Mental and Brain Research Institute of Texas. On Tuesday, House Bill 15, a bill to create the Mental Health and Brain Research Institute of Texas, MBRIT, passed the Texas House of Representatives. This legislation, with House Joint Resolution 135, would fund the first-ever research facility of this type in the United States. MBRIT allocates $3 billion to research in Texas to help attract the best and brightest researchers in the world, increase private investment research funds, and ensure all Texans benefit from the research. I am proud to have worked on this legislation with my fellow Dean Sinfronia Thompson, and I look forward to continuing this discussion throughout the session, Craddock said in a press release. This legislation would do more for mental health research, what the Cancer Prevention and Research Institute of Texas, CPRIT, did for cancer research, but Texas on the map as a worldwide leader. These research efforts are important to the success of generations to come in addressing the community's mental health needs. I'm honored to be able to work on such important legislation to all Texans. Craddock's Grow Legislation. State Republican Tom Craddock's legislation to bring state money generated by oil and gas production back to the Permian Basin and other energy-producing hotbeds is House Joint Resolution 27 and would create the Generate Recurring Oil Wealth for Texas Fund, GROW, G-R-O-W. The money could be used for roads, education, broadband, law enforcement, and many other of the required needs in these energy communities. According to a press release from Craddock's office, Joint Resolution 27 funds would be returned to where they originated to make improvements to expand roads and invest in infrastructure needed in the energy-producing areas. GROW has broad support from a variety of companies, trade associations, and individuals, according to Craddock's office. The money could be used for roads, education, broadband, law enforcement, and many other of the required needs in these energy communities. Some of the supporters include Apache, CenterPoint Energy, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Diamondback Energy, ExxonMobil, Halliburton, Motran Occidental Petroleum, Pioneer, Panhandle Producers, and Royalty Owner, PPROA, Texas Alliance of Energy Producers, Texas Association of Business, Texas Pipeline Association, Texas Independent Producers, and Royalty Owners Association, TIPRO, and Texas Oil and Gas Association, TXOGA, the news release said. Previously, the Grow Texas legislation has been passed out of the Texas House twice with more than 120 votes in support of the measure. It is expected to go before the House Appropriations Committee in the next week. Craddock, Landgraf differ on vouchers by Stuart Doreen. The vote in the Texas House on vouchers showed the representation of Midland Odessa differed on their respective views for school vouchers in Texas. On Thursday, the House voted 86-52 on Thursday to amend the budget to ban state funding for school vouchers or other similar programs, according to the Texas Tribune. Midland's state representative Tom Craddock voted against the amendment or voted in support of vouchers. Odessa State Representative Brooks Landgraf voted for the amendment or against vouchers. The promotion of vouchers has been a priority for Governor Greg Abbott and some conservatives this legislation session. Abbott was in Landgraf's backyard in Odessa in late March, trumpeting his desire to see more school choice opportunities, including the implementation of education savings accounts for Texas families. Kevin Sparks, the state senator for Midland and Odessa, told Reporter Telegram, school choice equips Texans with free market answers to improve the students' constitutional access to education, provides parents greater opportunities to access resources for their children, and broadens the type of environments in which teachers can instruct the next generation. Last week, the Texas Senate approved Senate Bill 8, which included an education savings account of $8,000 per school year. The vote was 18-13. Regarding the vote in Texas House, Landgraf offered in a statement to the Midland Reporter Telegram his reasons for supporting the amendment to ban state funding for vouchers or educational savings accounts. As a state representative, I take seriously my oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, which requires Texas to establish, support, maintain a system of free public schools, Landgraf wrote. That is why I have and I will continue to steadfastly uphold my constitutional oath to support Texas public school students and teachers, and why I voted for Amendment 45. However, I also believe in parental empowerment, and my vote on that amendment does not preclude me from seeking every available avenue to improve our system of education. I will therefore remain open and willing to listen to constituents about school choice. Craddock stated he continues to support vouchers and freedom of choice in our education system is important to all Texans. The taxpayer dollars used to support education in Texas should be used to support the education choice each parent makes for their child. Craddock wrote, sending a child to a school that best serves their needs is in their interest of all students, families, and Texans, and the future of Texas. It is time we give Texas families a choice to see what works best for them. Following the House vote, the Texas Tribune offered the following comment from the governor's office. Governor Abbott made education freedom an emergency item this legislative session because no one knows the needs of their child better than a parent. Abbott spokesperson Renee Ease said in a statement, "The amendment received the least support ever. This vote shows the legislature remains open to school choice, supporting the majority of Texans who want to expand school choice." City leaders hear details about entertainment district. Centennial District could come before council in next month, by Stuart Doreen. City of Midland staff appear to be making changes to the proposed entertainment district planned for downtown, and the changes start with the name Centennial District. The name pays tribute to Centennial Park, easily one of the signature landmarks in Midland. The changes to the entertainment district will not stop there. The district will be smaller than originally planned, encompassing the following boundaries: Big Spring Street to the west, Baird Street to the east, Missouri Street to the south, and Illinois Avenue to the north. City staff is expected to bring a final plan to the council maybe in the next month. Land uses expected include outdoor restaurants, interactive art, pop-up shops, and parklets. Additional permitted uses without an SUD specific use designation include restaurants, microbreweries, wineries, festivals and events, and bars, lounges, and nightclubs. Walkability is key to the entertainment district. Street redesign elements include curbless streets, striped pedestrian crosswalks, reduced speed limits, wider sidewalks, lighting that illuminates all walking spaces, and trees or planter boxes. Key design elements include alley improvements, increased lighting, signage, inviting street furniture, landscaping, bollards, and meter parking. Council members also saw Concepts redesign Texas Avenue to 2 or 1 travel lanes. Estimated expenses of creation of Centennial District include $1.158 million for capital expenses, include $1 million for Texas Avenue reconstruction, $70,000 for permanent bollards and Wall Street, $20,000 for signage, $20,000 for trash receptacles, and $48,000 for maintenance vehicles. Yearly operations expenses start at $458,977, including $200,000 for security, $86,546 for maintenance personnel, $79,917 for a parking enforcement officer, and $92,514 for a downtown coordinator. MPD detained suspect in death of 16-year-old by Mercedes Cordero. Midland police have detained a male juvenile in connection to the death of a 16-year-old in Northwest Midland. MPD reported that officers at about 1 p.m. Tuesday were called to the 8400 block of Skyline Avenue in Odessa, where they detained a male juvenile believed to be the primary suspect in yesterday's homicide. Officers are currently executing a search warrant related to the homicide. At about 5:30 p.m. Monday, MPD officers responded to the 3417 North Midland Drive regarding shots fired. Investigators found a 16-year-old male deceased at the scene with multiple gunshot wounds, MPD reported in a news release. The next of kin has been notified. The investigation is ongoing. MDC Spaceport Board creation could pay dividends by Stuart Doreen. The Midland Spaceport Development Corporation is back in business one day after county leaders agreed to authorize the creation of a development corporation. The Midland City Council did the same and picked its four members for the seven-person board. City leaders on Tuesday picked retired General Frank Kistner, Mayor Lori Blong, Councilwoman Robin Poole, and Councilwoman Amy Stretcher Burks as the city's selections. On Monday, county leaders had picked County Judge Terry Johnson, Commissioner Louis Sanchez, and Ed Anderson. The rebirth of the Spaceport Development Corporation will enable Midland to be eligible for funding from the state, according to Midland Development Corporation Executive Director Sarah Harris. There was previously a Spaceport Development Corporation in Midland in 2014, but it was dissolved in 2020. Governor Greg Abbott's recommendation to the 88th legislature was to provide $350 million for the creation of the Texas Space Commission to support the development of a coordinated strategic plan that will position Texas as a global leader in space travel, research, and technology. Legislation filed includes Senate Bill 1652, which calls for the creation, management, and administration of the Texas Space Commission and the Texas Aerospace Research and Space Economy Consortium. House Bill 3447 creates the Aerospace and Space Economy Consortium. Midland International Airport is home to one of the four spaceports in Texas, according to the FAA.
Electric Vehicles Will Not Crash the Texas Grid by Chris Tomlinson. Texans who survived the 2021 blackouts and watched the grid wobble last summer have good reason to worry about charging hundreds of thousands of electric vehicles in the near future. EVs accounted for 7% of new vehicle registrations in the United States in January, up from 4% the year earlier, and could double again. Automakers offered 47 models, including sedans, pickups, SUVs, and luxury cars in 2022, and more than 150 are expected in 2025, reported S&P Global Mobility, a data and consulting firm. Thanks to new tax credits, EV sales are expected to climb dramatically with more cars plugging into the grid. But electricity company executives insist we have nothing to worry about and say EVs will help stabilize the grid, not overload it. Last week, I attended the Energy Thought Summit in Austin, where the best and brightest minds in the electric power industry compared notes. They discussed how additional revenue from EV charging will help finance and justify desperately needed grid upgrades. Not only can the grid take it, it's good for the grid, Drew Higgins, Senior Director of Products and Services for San Antonio CPS Energy, told the audience. EVs are good, nice, scheduled loads that charge at night off-peak, and you can incentivize people to charge when you want them to and where you want them to, and in the future, maybe even provide energy back. Visit the Electric Reliability Council of Texas website, and you can see how demand for power swings over 24 hours, and with it, the price ERCOT pays for electricity. If a utility can encourage EV owners to charge when demand is low, it will boost prices during the off-peak period and make generating electricity more profitable. We compensate our customers for basically working with the utility to charge when and where we want them to. And then on top of that, we have different types of rebates based, once again, upon that scheduling, Higgins explained. The Energy Systems Integration Group, a nonprofit and nonpartisan industry research organization, released two white papers last week detailing how EVs can boost grid stability. DNV, a risk management firm, agreed that EVs will improve the grid. With the power grid transitioning from a conventional, unidirectional energy delivery model to a more decentralized one, the significance of flexible solutions at the consumer level, such as EV batteries, is critical, the firm found. The average EV in Texas consumes $450 in electricity annually, boosting utility revenues. Higgins explained that of every dollar spent, 76 cents stays in the community. With gasoline, only 7 cents of every dollar stay behind. More money for the community means a more modern grid. San Diego Gas and Electric updated its equipment to successfully experiment with using electric school buses for backup power. Thousands of buses can provide a significant amount of dispatchable energy during hot summer days or cold winter nights when school is out and buses are idle. Upgrade the grid further, and every EV owner can turn their vehicle into a backup power source for their home or sell their extra electricity back to the grid at a higher price. That technology exists. All we need is the Public Utilities Commission to approve it and for utilities to install it. Planning will, because the forecasted amount of new EV load is set to outpace the scheduled amount of new renewable energy generation by 2040. Too many clean energy projects remain tied up in red tape while fossil fuel plants close because they are uneconomic. Luckily, electric utilities are full of people whose job is to plan and design grid updates. And because most companies involved are for-profit, they are incentivized to solve problems. Steady growth in EV purchases present one of the few bright spots for electricity generators that might otherwise see a drop in demand due to energy efficiency. New demands on the transmission and distribution system create an opportunity for utilities such as CenterPoint, CPS, or electric cooperatives to make money upgrading worn wires and transformers that deliver power. Additional demand also means more revenue for retail electricity providers, which profit from shifting load from the most expensive time of the day to nights and weekends. Most of all, consumers profit from lower lifetime operating costs of their vehicle, a cleaner environment, and less global warming. The only losers are oil companies. The switch to EVs is accelerating, but there is no reason to worry about the electric grid's reliability. If we embrace the change with new technology, the grid will be better than ever. Exxon Pioneer deal would spell end to an era in fracking, by Liam Denning. Sometimes the best answer to the question of why you would do a deal is another question, why not? Less than a week after OPEC Plus delivered a jolt to the oil sector, Good Friday saw a Wall Street Journal report that ExxonMobil and Pioneer Natural Resources had talked about a potential tie-up. Big oil talks to big fracker is, of course, a classic of the genre. Yet there may be something to this latest addition. A decade ago, Pioneer traded at a market multiple of EBITDA that was about 50% higher than Exxon's. I've used EBITDA rather than earnings due to the effects of the 2014 oil crash and the pandemic. Today, Exxon trades at a slightly premium to Pioneer, but both are at a discount of about 50% to the S&P 500. Two things happened. First, the WeWork economics of the shale boom, whereby investors and creditors financed a land grab that mainly benefited consumers via effectively subsidized energy prices, imploded. Second, that implosion, as well as growing concerns about oil demand peaking some point sooner than never, took the whole energy sector down relative to the wider market. In response, oil companies had to remake themselves as cash payers rather than growth engines if they were to even get their calls returned by investors. And the survivors have done this with remarkable discipline, aided by the supercharged cash flows provided courtesy of Russia's war in Ukraine. Pioneer exemplified the earlier boom, at one point announcing a 10-year plan to boost production to 1 million barrels a day. In the decade through 2019, Pioneer's cumulative free cash burn was $6.8 billion. Last year alone, when it produced about 650,000 barrels equivalent per day, it generated positive free cash flow of $7.3 billion and then paid out more than 100% of that. This is what investors wanted, yet there is precious little sign of Pioneer or the wider sector getting a higher multiple in return. The startup culture financing model of shale 1.0 has given way to a shale 2.0 that is something closer to the model of the integrated oil majors like Exxon. When Pioneer was rumored recently to be considered buying another fracker itself, punishment was swift. For someone like Scott Sheffield, Pioneer's chief executive and founder, shale's middle age must pale somewhat in comparison to its earlier iteration. So if Exxon is interested in paying a premium, what would be the compelling reason to say no? As for Exxon, the oil world has shifted its way. High prices have taken the major's cash flow to levels that surpass even the 2008 peak oil price vintage. Exxon has built a formidable position in the Permian Basin that allows it to dial production up and down on a more flexible basis, allaying peak oil concerns to some degree and complementing more traditional megaprojects like its Guyana discoveries. Adding Pioneer would offer more inventory in a core business at a scale that makes a difference to Exxon, and with a lot of overlapping acreage in the southern Midland portion of the Permian, allowing for some operational efficiencies. Regular cost savings for general and administrative expenses are negligible. Above all, by Good Friday, Pioneer's stock-for-stock price relative to Exxon's was at its cheapest level since the early pandemic crash. Exxon will be very price-sensitive. Its earlier splash in shale, the acquisition of XTO Energy Incorporated in 2010, was aimed at bulking up in natural gas, just ahead of an extended bear market in that fuel. That misstep haunted then-CEO Rex Tillerson thereafter. Current valuations look more aligned. Unusually, Exxon stock was actually up on Monday morning despite being a rumored buyer. This reflects the sector's continued evolution from startup free-for-all to something more boring and, frankly, Exxon-like. The logic of scale efficiencies to exploit shale rather than pioneer it is inexorable. Good day, this is Glenn, and I'm going to be reading today from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Wednesday, April 12, 2023. OPEC succeeds in banishing short sellers with surprise cut, by Grant Smith. OPEC is winning its war against short sellers. The coalition led by Saudi Arabia said that last week's shock decision to slash oil production was intended to punish speculators and deter them from making unwarranted wagers against crude prices. If that was the rationale, then the latest data show the group succeeded. Money managers slashed short positions in Brent crude by 29,118 contracts in the week to April 4th, the sharpest drop since 2020, according to data from ICE Futures Europe. In percentage terms, last week's 46% reduction is the biggest in data going back to 2011. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies pledged more than 1 million barrels a day of cutbacks starting in May after fears over bankrolling turmoil and faltering economic growth led to a pileup of short positions, dragging crude prices down to $70 a barrel last month. The market promptly recovered with futures trading near $84 a barrel in London on Tuesday. The higher price levels should help many OPEC nations cover government spending.
Carol Jo Blake, 94, a loving wife and mother, peacefully passed away Thursday, March 30, 2023, surrounded by her family and caregivers. A visitation will be held from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock Thursday, April 13, 2023, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. The celebration of her life will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, April 14, 2023, at the Episcopal Church of the Holy Trinity. Intermeet will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, please make a donation to the Episcopal Church of the Holy Trinity, Hospice of Midland, Midland College, or a charity of your choosing. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. David Nelson Grimes of Midland, Texas, passed away at home on Good Friday, April 7, 2023. Visitation will be from 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. Thursday, April 13th, 2023, at the branch at NPW, and memorial service will be at First Presbyterian Church of Midland Friday, April 14th, 2023, at 2 p.m. with Pastor Steve Score officiating. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Evelyn Joyce O'Neill, our beloved mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, Evelyn Joyce O'Neill, sweetie, 91, passed away peacefully on April 6, 2023, in Odessa, Texas. A visitation for Evelyn will be held from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Wednesday, April 12, 2023, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, April 13, 2023, at Rest Haven Memorial Park. In lieu of flowers for the family, suggest donations be made in Evelyn's honor to the Permian Warrior Partnership or the First Baptist Church of Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home, Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Jennifer Dunn, February 5, 1973 to April 10, 2023. Jennifer J. Dunn, 50, of Odessa, Texas, was called to heaven on the 10th of April, 2023, following a brief illness. A celebration of Jen's life will be held on Friday, the 14th of April, 2023, at 11 o'clock a.m. at Crossroads Church with young adult pastor Javon Johnson officiating. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorials be made to the Live Like Riley Foundation, www.livelikeriley.org. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home in Odessa. To send condolences to the family, please sign her guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. John Frank Campbell was born September 19, 1934, the seventh child of Reverend Irie C. and Bertha M. Campbell in Ladonia, Texas. A wake service will be held on Friday, April 14, 2023, from 6 p.m. until 8 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Homegoing celebration will be Saturday, April 15, 2023, at 1 p.m. at New Jerusalem Baptist Church. Funeral arrangements have been entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at asanchez.tfh.com.
This is Thoris with the Odessa American News for Wednesday, April the 12th. The headlines read, County approves selling e-cigs to inmates. Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths displayed to the Ector County Commissioner's Court the e-cigarette he plans to sell to inmates at the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. After a brief presentation from Griffiths, the court approved the sale of e-cigarettes to inmates at no cost to the county or taxpayers, with all proceeds collected earmarked for use at the jail. Griffiths explained to members of the media Tuesday morning in the commissioner's courtroom at the Ector County Administration Annex, room 120, 1010 East 8th Street, the e-cigarettes are correction grade. There's a specific company that makes these e-cigs and tries to make them alter-proof, Griffiths said. The e-cig has to be returned in the state that it was given to them or they won't get another one. Ector County Judge Dustin Fawcett said his hesitation with selling the e-cigarettes to inmates subsidized after Griffiths spoke about the matter and had a physical example of what the e-cigarette will look like. The e-cigarette is clear with a barcode on the inside. The barcode will be scanned and matched to the inmate who purchases that e-cigarette, and it will be re-scanned when it is brought back. My biggest hesitation was, can inmates use these e-cigarettes for something nefarious, Fawcett said. After looking at the e-cigarette and speaking with Sheriff Griffiths, they put their time in looking at the different vendors, and I believe this particular product is going to be one that will be safe for the inmates, safe for the jailers, and safe for all the staff. The cost of the e-cigarette will be $3.85 each. That come in a 50-count package. Griffiths said one e-cigarette is the equivalent to a standard pack of cigarettes. 20. The jail plans to have an initial order of 1,000. The cost to the inmates will be $14. That includes $1.07 in sales tax. Griffiths said inmates can purchase e-cigarettes with their commissionary funds. Griffiths said inmates can only purchase and have one e-cigarette at a time, and before the inmate can purchase another e-cigarette, they have to return their initial e-cigarette purchase and have it re-scanned into the system. Griffiths said if the e-cigarette has been tampered with, that inmate won't be able to purchase any more e-cigarettes. If you don't abuse it, then you get to use it, Griffiths said. If someone starts trying to do other things with it, that individual isn't getting another one. The court also approved the jail to sell pizza to inmates at no cost to the county or taxpayers, with all proceeds to be used at the jail. Griffiths said the sale of pizza is mainly for Sundays and Mondays, but the purchase and sale prices haven't been finalized. Local news roundup. Traffic stop leads to fentanyl-related arrest. A traffic stop Saturday night led to the arrest of an Odessa man and the seizure of 2.6 grams of fentanyl-laced oxycodone pills. According to an Odessa Police Department report, an officer pulled Devon Dunn, age 19, over because he was failing to maintain a single lane while traveling north on Andrews Highway near East 38th Street, and his Cadillac Seville wasn't insured. After smelling marijuana inside the car, the officer searched it and found a handgun under Dunn's seat, along with a satchel containing $686 and 2.6 grams of blue pills labeled M30, the report stated. Dunn's girlfriend told the officer Dunn sold the pills, according to the report. Dunn was arrested on suspicion of manufacturing, delivery of a controlled substance, possession of a controlled substance, and unlawfully carrying a weapon. Dunn remained in the Ector County Jail Tuesday on surety bonds totaling $41,500. The manufacturing charge is a second-degree felony punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. Alleged scooter attack lands teen in jail. An Odessa teenager is facing an aggravated assault charge after his mother's boyfriend told police he attacked him with a scooter. According to an Odessa Police Department report, a 49-year-old South Jackson Avenue resident called authorities around 2 p.m. Saturday and said Romero Tinner, age 17, entered the bedroom he shared with the teen's mother and began to beat him with a child's scooter. Officers observed injuries to the man's arm, and Tinner's mother confirmed hearing the attack from another room, the report stated. Tinner was arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. He remained in the Ector County Jail Tuesday on a $25,000 surety bond. Midland teen shot to death. The Midland Police Department is investigating the shooting death of a 16-year-old boy. According to the City of Midland, police responding to a shots fire call in the 3400 block of North Midland Drive around 5:30 p.m. Monday found the deceased teenager suffering from multiple gunshot wounds. No other information was immediately available. Odessian accused in aggravated assault. An Odessa man was arrested early Sunday morning after his roommate of 4 months accused him of assault. According to an Odessa Police Department report, two La Casa Drive residents from separate homes called 911 shortly after 3:30 a.m. Sunday to advise someone was at their door seeking help. When officers arrived at the homes, one of the men seeking help was gone, but at the other home, they found a 36-year-old man covered in blood, the report stated. The man told officers Sean Paul Durate, 33, attacked him, striking him in the head several times and causing him to fear for his life, according to the report. Officers saw blood smeared near the front door, throughout a hallway, kitchen, and several bedrooms, the report stated. Officers found Durate at a residence in the 1600 block of San Fernando Drive, and he claimed he'd been strangled to the point of unconsciousness with a weed-eater wire. Although Officers noted his neck was red. Durante didn't have bloodshot eyes, which is typical of strangulation victims, the report stated. An officer also noted in his report, Durante's account of the incident was inconsistent, and his claim that he fled the apartment first seeking help was proven false by neighboring video camera footage. Durante was arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. He remained in the Ector County Jail Tuesday on a $40,000 surety bond. All About Spring Harvest by United Supermarkets Dietitian Team. With the warm weather and the longer days, plants are growing again and flowers are blossoming. The energy level is going up, and people are starting to enjoy more outdoor activities like hiking, attending spring festivals, and barbecuing. Fruits provide nutrients vital for the health and maintenance of your body. Most fruit options are low in fat, sodium, and calories, and have no cholesterol. Fiber is yet again another main function of produce. On top of having a slew of different micronutrients like folate, vitamin C, and potassium, fiber helps reduce blood cholesterol levels, keeps you feeling fuller longer, lowers the risk of heart disease. Important for proper bowel function, try and make as many of your sources whole sources. All vegetables count here, whether they are freeze-dried, frozen, canned, fresh, dried, and so on. Fiber, yet again, takes the center stage as to why it is so important to consume them. The amount of vegetables you need varies, but the general rule of thumb for an adult is 5 to 9 servings. A serving is 1 cup raw or 1/2 cup cooked. Most vegetables are naturally low in fat and calories and include a wide range of nutrients like vitamin A, vitamin K, polyphenols, antioxidants, and much more. It's important to note that eating a wide variety is key. Eating fruit and vegetables provides several different health benefits. People who eat more fruits and vegetables as part of an overall healthy diet are likely to have a reduced risk of some chronic diseases. Midland Habitat for Humanity dedicates 187th house in program's history. Midland Habitat for Humanity dedicated its 187th house located at 801 East Odessa Street to a deserving homeowner on March the 24th. Made possible through the generous support of churches participating in the Apostle Build, this new home will provide a secure and affordable living space for a hardworking Odessa family. The Apostle Build is a program where local churches sponsor the construction of a habitat house from start to finish. The program is named after the 12 apostles who left their regular occupations to follow Jesus and help build his church. Similarly, participants in the Apostle Build give their time, resources, and energy to build a home for a family in need. The 187th Habitat Home Build was made possible by the financial contributions and volunteer work of the following churches: Antioch Christian Church, Connections Christian Church, Emmanuel Baptist, First Baptist of Odessa, Mid-City Search, New Life Fellowship, and The Bridge. Their hard work and dedication helped make this dream a reality for the homeowner, who has put in their own sweat equity and contributed to the building of their new home. MHFH is one of the premier institutions responsible for constructing affordable housing in the Permian Basin. The organization's partnership model offers deserving, hardworking families a hand up. MHFH uses a rigorous qualifying process that includes progress from the applicant through home ownership. Each participant contributes a minimum of 350 hours of sweat equity on the worksite and completes a homeownership education program. Successful candidates are then awarded a 0% interest mortgage, making homeownership a reality for some of the most deserving families in the Permian Basin. Midland Habitat for Humanity is a Christian-based nonprofit organization that builds homes for low-income families trapped in substandard housing. Homeowners make house payments to Habitat with a 0% interest, 25-year mortgage. These house payments go into a fund to build more homes. For more information, call 432-686-8877. PBRC to hold 46th annual telethon. For more than 45 years, the Permian Basin Rehab Center has hosted an annual telethon to help raise funds to help provide crucial therapy services to patients. Every year since the first telethon, the PBRC has been thankful for the support from donors in the Odessa and Midland communities. The fundraiser, in which the PBRC teams up with News West 9, is held each spring. This year's telethon broadcast will take place from 6:30 to 10 p.m. April 15th and 2 to 5:30 p.m. April 16th and can be viewed on News West 9. Telethon gives PBRC a chance to share the stories of its patients and thank the donors who helped make it all possible. The event helps the center provide services including physical therapy, speech language pathology, audiology, and occupational therapy. This year's telethon will take place at Odessa Christian Faith Center. Obituaries. Kenneth Fletcher, age 75, passed away on April the 6th. Socorro Armendariz, age 73, passed away on April the 6th. Jennifer Dunn, age 50, of Odessa, passed away on April the 10th. Jimmy Arnold, age 77, died April the 1st. Christine Shane Curry, age 52, of Odessa, died Saturday, April the 1st. Laura Urban, age 53, of Midland, died Saturday, April the 8th. Sharon Lyons, age 86, died on March the 24th. Margaret Ann McFall, age 93, passed away on Thursday, March the 23rd. Armando Ramirez Chavarrera, age 67, died Tuesday, April the 4th. Evelyn O'Neill, age 91, of Midland, died Thursday, April the 6th. Reynold Sanchez Quiroz, age 80, of Odessa, died Sunday, March the 26th. Helen Joyce Phillips, age 93, passed away on Saturday, April the 8th.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, April 10th. Teacher vacancy recommendations appreciated. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. Organizations like Raise Your Hand Texas and the Fast Growth School Coalition say recommendations issued by the State Teacher Vacancy Task Force are appreciated, but not surprising. Some should have been taken on years ago. Bob Popinski, Senior Director of Policy for Raise Your Hand Texas, said the conversation about the teacher workforce has been going on for some time, and there is a lot of meat to put on the bones of the overarching recommendations. Quote, "You're dealing with pay, with teacher culture, with how you train and prepare your teachers for the teacher workforce. So there's definitely a lot of moving pieces within these recommendations," Popinski said. He added that a lot of these conversations have been going on for years in Texas. Quote, "We have a teaching staff of roughly 375,000 teachers across the state, and we lose almost 37% of them by year five. We know we've had a teacher workforce issue for quite some time, so how do you attract teachers into the profession? How do you retain them, and how do you pay them a wage that will keep them in the profession, but also give them the support and the opportunities they need through mentorship programs in the process? So what this sets out is, number one, they definitely understand that pay is an issue. Texas is currently $7,500 below the national average in teacher pay. That's one of their first recommendations. They didn't put a number on this. They just basically said, let's increase overall compensation through an increase to the basic allotment, Popinski said. That aligns with Raise Your Hand's recommendation to increase the basic allotment. Right now, the basic allotment is about $1,000 below where it needs to be just to keep up with inflation since 2019. School districts don't have the same purchasing power as they did in 2019, and where about 50% of a school district budget goes toward teachers' salaries. That's a big driving force. So their recommendation to increase the basic allotment, which automatically triggers a certain percentage to go to teacher pay, is a good recommendation. We suggest that they increase that basic allotment by $1,000, and so that's the first big priority of this bill, he added. Next, he said, is to enhance total teacher compensation. Quote, they're looking at retirement benefits, health insurance, and how to improve that. That's much needed as well. They're trying to figure out how to incentivize teachers to go into hard-to-staff areas like bilingual and special education to be paid for their certification process, as well as how to improve the pipeline for pre-service preparation. Can we pay for scholarships for residency programs that allow teachers to have year-long residency programs and be paid for it in a way that they don't get a hit to their budget trying to be well-prepared and trained to be ready on day one, Popinski said. Grow your own programs were also recommended. Popinski said these need funding and staff to make sure you have the right staff to have these programs in place. Asked about the chances these recommendations will make it through the legislature, Popinski said there is a definite need. Quote, I think it is a priority not only in this organization, but a lot of organizations and leadership over at the Capitol to do something with teacher workforce. We know from the Charles Butt poll that was released that 77% of our teachers have considered leaving the profession, and that's just not sustainable to have teacher shortage areas. That's been systemic in our teacher workforce for quite some time, whether as special education teachers, bilingual teachers, or math teachers. We know that's been a problem, so in addition to teachers wanting to leave the profession because of pay and other support issues, he added. There are still roughly 3 months left in the legislative session and a lot of different opinions on how to do these things. Quote, there is enough funding to get this done. The state has a historic beginning balance, a historic revenue estimate moving forward. There is enough to pay our teachers more to get them on track on the national average. There are ways to bolster our high-quality traditional preparation programs. Right now, 16% of our teachers come from the ALT certification programs. Some of them have varying degrees of training our teachers to be ready. And so looking at that to make sure that we have high-quality teachers coming out of all preparation programs is going to be high on folks' minds, as well as doing a broad search for trying to attract teachers into the profession, Popinski said. I think a lot of these issues are going to have really deep conversations. We're just happy this elevated the conversation, but like I said at the beginning, there's a lot of meat to put on the bones, a lot of policy issues to be discussed. There's roughly 1,000 bills filed related to education issues every legislative session, and these alone are some pretty heavy lifts, end quote. The average teacher's salary in Texas is $57,600 a year. Popinski said, when you adjust that over the last 10 years for inflation, that's increased by a little under $2,000. He added that it varies by years of service. The basic allotment, which, raise your hand, also favors increasing, is the building block on how schools are funded. Quote, think of it as a $6,100, and that's what every student in the state starts with, and then you add on some student characteristics to that. So if you're a special needs student, or a student that qualifies for free and reduced lunch, or gets in gifted and talented programs, or bilingual programs, you can add on allotments to that, or add on weights to that, Popinski said. Once you start adding on the weights and allotments to that average, students average about $10,000 across the state. That can vary based on district or campus and student characteristics. On average, he said, it's about $10,000 per student. Attached to the basic allotment in Texas law is a provision that says any time the basic allotment is increased, a certain percentage of that increase has to go to teachers' salary increases. Greg Smith, executive director of the Fast Growth School Coalition and former Clear Creek ISD superintendent, said his only concern about the recommendations is that they're probably 4 years later than what they needed to be. Quote, "This is not a problem that is just in 2022-2023. This is a problem that folks have seen going on for several years, that the pipeline was drying up and people weren't getting into the education field," Smith said. He said he doesn't know if people just thought it would change overnight without the injection of any recommendations, but overall, it's a great starting point. Quote, "They had the experts in the room with the teachers asking them, why are they staying? Why are they doing what they're doing? And then the autopsy report of why are people leaving the profession so early," Smith said. "I think they addressed it from the financial standpoint in terms of salary compensation." Having said that, he thinks there are areas for improvement on the legislation part. Quote, "I think there's the same thing for universities as well as school districts. I don't think it's just let's point a finger at the legislature. I think this is something that people need to be grabbing hold of with respect to their own educational environment, whether it's in your neck of the woods or whether it's mine. There's room for improvement, and it's going to take everyone working collectively to dig ourselves out of this. We're all pretty much to blame for putting us into this situation to begin with," end quote. Asked if COVID was an accelerant, Smith said he thinks so. Quote, "It certainly revealed itself about how hard this is and the risks associated with it. It got to a point where it exacerbated the situation even more so. In our Fast Growth School Coalition, we really felt like there needed to be some sort of injection into the system for incentives and taking close looks at some things we can do better with respect to creating less stress on the teachers and creating more joy," Smith said. Many teachers in ECISD, for example, have 1 to 5 years of experience and 20 or more years, but not a lot in the middle. Quote, "The mentor thing, I think, is important, and that was addressed. It's addressed, but it's addressed in name only. The devil's in the details on this, and what goes into being a mentor to help people through the turbulent times of starting out once you're handed the keys to the door. What does that look like?" End quote. At Clear Creek, Smith said they gave teachers lesson plan guides starting out. Quote, "I do think we need to look at opportunities to create some different mentoring opportunities for veteran teachers to work with incoming teachers and help them over the hump. I think what we've come to grips with is if you can find me someone that's kind, caring, compassionate, and willing to learn, we can teach you the content. So, if you can find that instructional aid, let's put them on the fast track to become a classroom teacher," Smith said. He added that if the governor, lieutenant governor, and speaker are on the same page, things like pay increases for teachers are going to get done. "There are lots of questions about vouchers or education savings accounts." Smith said there is some research on vouchers in Arizona and Milwaukee that might indicate that vouchers are reducing the cost for students already in private schools. Quote, "But as far as the actual movement of students from public schools to vouchers and having an onslaught of reductions in student population, I think the jury's still out on that," Smith said. He added that this was a, quote, great wake-up call for the public school sector to realize that you're not a monopoly anymore, and you better make sure the services that you're providing to the kids, first and foremost, are going to be something that the community's proud of after tracking the data," end quote. Popinski said private schools educate 5.4 million kids. Quote, "I think that the Universal Education Savings Account, or vouchers, are a conversation that's going to be had and it's going to impact public education. If it does pass, and our organization hopes that vouchers or ESAs are not passed, we think it's a bad state policy. It does siphon money away from public schools. Think of a small campus with 4 or 5 kids leaving for a voucher program. Those 4 or 5 kids are distributed across the campus in different grade levels, but by them leaving, the campus loses $10,000 per student. So $50,000 to some of these small rural campuses is a teacher's salary. Those campuses still have to have a teacher in every classroom. They still have to have a bus driver in every bus. They still have to have a cafeteria worker to help with food service. And so, yes, it does siphon off money from public schools and potentially including teachers and an impact on how you can staff up your teaching workforce within a campus or a school district," Popinski said. Career shift. Trainer makes jump to academia. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. After 20 years of practicing athletic training in a clinical setting, Brian Bobbier is now in his second year at University of Texas Permian Basin. Bobbier is clinical assistant professor and coordinator of clinical education for the athletic training program. Quote, "This is a complete career shift for me. I spent the first 20 years of my athletic training career practicing in the clinical setting in a wide variety of places around the country and different patient populations. This is something that's really new," Bobbier said. The clinical settings include stops at the University of Houston, the University of Texas, Kansas State University, the Texas Rangers, and Miami Marlins. During his time in professional baseball, Bobbier served in various roles within the Rangers and Marlins organization, including rehabilitation coordinator and athletic training coordinator. An Oklahoma City native, Bobbier arrived at UTPB in 2021 after working as an educator and athletic trainer in the secondary school setting at Okarchi Public Schools in Okarchi, Oklahoma, the UTPB website said. While at Okarchi, he served on the Oklahoma Athletic Trainers Association Secondary Schools Committee and volunteered as a host athletic trainer for the NCAA Division I Women's College World Series in Oklahoma City. Quote, "As the athletic training coordinator, you oversee the medical operations on the minor league side. You review draft medicals for the upcoming draft, free agent medical reviews, work on policy procedures, work hand-in-hand with the major league staff on players coming up and down, and implementing risk reduction techniques throughout the organization," Bobbier said. He did get to work one major league game. Quote, "That was with the Texas Rangers. They came out to Arizona for a series against the Diamondbacks, and the spring training complex for the Rangers is out in Surprise, Arizona. So I did get to work one game with the Rangers in the big league team. That was fun. And then spring training, we all kind of shifted and got some time working the major league games because they usually have 60 to 70 players in major league camp right now. With just 3 athletic trainers, that's hard to do, so you kind of float back and forth and get that experience. When the guys get sent down, they kind of start getting back to normal staff," Bobbier said. Bobbier has played baseball since he was in kindergarten and loved the game ever since. He earned a bachelor's degree in professional studies from the University of Oklahoma, a master's in physical education with an emphasis in sports and fitness administration, and a doctor of athletic training degree from A.T. Still University, Arizona School of Health Sciences, in 2022. Quote, "When I was at college, I just thought, you know, this might be an interesting career path. It was my sophomore year. I applied for a PBATS, which is a Professional Baseball Athletic Trainer Society summer internship. I was at home in Oklahoma City, and they have a AAA team, who at the time was affiliated with the Texas Rangers. That athletic trainer was Greg Harrell. Greg called me up and said, 'Hey, would you like to do a four-game series?' And I was like, 'Absolutely.' So I came up there and just did a quick four-game series and then kept in touch with Greg. Then my last 2 years at college at OU, I did summer internships with them," Bobbier said. All summer long, Bobbier was with Harrell for home games. His last year, Bobbier was with them until the 1st of July. He started his grad assistantship with the University of Houston. He continued keeping in touch with Harrell. In 2002, a year and a half into his graduate assistantship and working on his master's, Harrell called Bobbier and said if he was still interested in pro baseball, as they had a few openings in the organization. Bobbier sent his information to the coordinator at the time, Frank Velasquez, and from there, Bobbier was off. He added that it's a year-round job. Bobbier and his wife Jill have a daughter named Madison. Jill is a first-grade teacher at St. Mary's Central Catholic School. Bobbier added that the two of them have taught everywhere. He noted that traveling for professional teams involves a lot of wear and tear. Quote, "It's not really conducive for a good work-life balance because you're gone 6 or 7 months out of the year. You're not home very much, if at all. My wife and I adopted a little girl in 2018, and that kind of changed perspective of life for us. So that's when I decided to take a step back. Between 2018 and when I started here in 2021, I was working at a high school, working on my doctorate degree as a teacher and athletic trainer. That gave me a little bit more of a work-life balance for my family," Bobbier said. He added that he enjoyed the academic side. Quote, "It's fun, it's enjoyable, and I feel like I'm giving something back to the profession. Teaching students that want to be athletic trainers is very rewarding. It's a change of pace. It's still a lot of work with planning and putting together lessons and showing them hands-on skills and time management, but teaching future athletic trainers has been a joy. I get to be at home a little bit more, so that's a plus," Bobbier said. He added that his students at UTPB want to be there. Quote, "They've made a commitment to athletic training, human performance. They're very invested into their education. At the high school level, you had the classes. I taught anatomy, physiology, and sports medicine, which were essentially electives. Students were placed into those, and they may not have been wanting to be in there, and that's perfectly fine. But here, students are invested. They want to be in it. They are driven, and that's a great thing to see, because with the students we have, I know that the profession is in good hands moving forward," Bobbier said. He added that he's impressed with the staff, vision, and technology in athletic training and the related areas. Quote, "There's a lot of room for growth, and I think there's a lot of great ideas at this institution. Meeting with our program director and department chair, Alana Dennison, her vision for the program for the department as well drew me here. There's a collective effort seeing what everybody's vision is and what we want to take this program to was very enticing, Bobbier said. Dennison said Bobbier has been an instant asset to the faculty. Quote, his wealth of professional experience combined with his passion for athletic training and incredible commitment to our students has had a significant impact on our program. He has added a number of unique clinical education sites for our students to gain diverse experiences and has been instrumental in the development of our Master of Science in Athletic Training program. We are very thankful to work alongside Brian and appreciate all of the incredible things he brings to our program and university, Dennison said. Clinical Assistant Professor M. Spencer Kane said Bobbier is an awesome individual to work with. Quote, his robust clinical practice experience has allowed us to collaborate in various innovative ways in both our academic programs and research studies here at UT Permian Basin, she said.